Eight Nights, copyright 2013 by John Speed. Night 6. It's 99% probable that if you're hearing this, you're living in a Judeo-Christian culture. That religious heritage impinges into all kinds of aspects of our lives, and yet we're blissfully unaware. Our seven-day week, weekends, why wine is sort of hip and sophisticated, but beer or whiskey is kind of slutty or derelicty, why practically every man my age is circumcised, why I really should make a list. You really should make a list. The thing is, it's everywhere. We're like fish. We're swimming in this heritage, and we have no idea there's such a thing as water. Like tonight, we're going to find out about the origin of synagogues. Wouldn't that be interesting? Do you know they started 2,500 years ago? I love knowing stuff like that. Even if there'd never been a great miracle, it'd be fun to hear this story, just so you could know stuff like that. But the fact is, a great miracle happened there, and the story of the great miracle gets closer with each candle we light. There are only two more candles to go. I can hardly wait. So, in case you're wondering, tonight we're going to talk about 475 to 175 BEC. Tomorrow we're going to talk about 175 to 165 BCE. And then on night 8, we're going to talk about 165 BCE, the great miracle. Tonight's installment covers a lot of amazing change. Last night we talked about the changes in the way the Jews thought about the world and their relationship to Hashem. Tonight we'll be talking about the way the world was changing around them. And was it ever changing? But first things first, the Jews left Babylon and returned to Jerusalem, some of them. That is, not all of them, not by a long shot. The strange thing is how few of the Jews actually returned. You can never be sure of numbers in the Bibles, but only about a tenth of the Jews who might have returned actually came back to Jerusalem. Maybe that was 5,000, maybe it was 50,000. Anyway, it was a lot fewer than all the Jews living there. After living in Babylon for 80 years, people thought of themselves as Babylonian Jews or Persian Jews or something, but not as Israelites. They had farms. They had families there and friends. None of them had ever lived in Israel. Those that made the trek came back to a not-so-wonderful, patched-together version of what once had been a pretty nice city. At the top of Mount Zion was a patched-up version of what once had been a pretty awesome temple. The Persians, who were pretty smart cookies, appointed a Jew to be the governor of the client state of Israel, Nehemiah. Even the Jews must have thought he did an okay job. He got his own book in the Old Testament. Nehemiah and Ezra, a Levite priest and a scribe, accompanied by the temple's first high priest, a fellow named Joshua, then dedicated the rebuilt temple. Nehemiah asked everybody in Jerusalem to gather in the courtyard. The crowd, from all accounts, wasn't that big. Then Ezra read the whole of the law aloud, pausing from time to time to make sure everyone understood. It took all afternoon. When it was done, everybody went home. But the blue flame of Shekinah did not fall from the sky and walk through the courtyard into the tabernacle. When Yom Kippur rolled around and the high priest didn't have to worry about pronouncing the secret hidden name of the Lord correctly. Remember last night when I asked rhetorically whether anyone even remembered it? Turns out nobody did. The name had been forgotten. And when it came time for the high priest to sprinkle the goat's blood on the ark, well, there was no ark to sprinkle. No righteous man had yet come to recover it, I guess. So on that Yom Kippur, and every Yom Kippur to follow, the high priest just stood in the tabernacle next to the place where the ark would have been and sprinkled the goat's blood on the floor. The Ark was gone. I don't want to spoil your evening, but nobody was going to see the face of the Most High in a cloud. Not then. Not ever again. I'm going to let that scene settle in for a moment. Oh, my old back, the winter rain drizzling in the courtyard. Your hair drips, your clothes are damp and they chilly and they cling to your skin. What little sunlight manages to sneak past the dreary, heavy clouds only washes the color out of everything. What do you think? Exiled Jews standing in the cold rain. Are you glad to be back? Now, by the end of tonight's installment, 300 years will have passed, and the entire scene will be quite different. The courtyard will be filled almost to bursting with beautiful, well-dressed people. The altar will be roaring with flame. The tabernacle will be faced with gorgeous white marble and decked out with gold. The temple will be more beautiful and more grand than even it was in Solomon's day. It might confuse you that no one in the temple is speaking Hebrew, that everyone is speaking Greek. It might confuse you how gloriously rich everyone looks, even the temple priests. And when you walk through Jerusalem, you scarcely know what to make of it. Along with being a great spiritual center, it has become, in 300 years, one of the most important financial centers on earth. All the trappings of wealth, huge, rich houses, vast estates, fabulous shops, all the rest, things you might expect to see in Athens or Alexandria or Antioch. That's what you see in Jerusalem that day. A lot of things will have changed since the day the duct-taped, rebuilt temple was rededicated. So first, let's talk about the Jews. We've talked about what happened to the Jews who were involved with the exile. Let's talk about what happened to the Jews that weren't involved. Without a king, the Jews that didn't get rounded up and exiled returned to their nomadic agricultural lives. Most of them, they formed little ad hoc tribes again, ad hoc alliances, a lot of farmland that had been owned by Jews that had gotten taken to Babylon. So who owned that land now? Anybody who grabbed it, essentially. So families started trying to stake out property for themselves. There was really no one to stop them. You can imagine the scene. There was no government. The tribal leaders were gone. Things could get pretty brutal. The Jews used to have to stay close enough to Jerusalem to get back to the temple three times a year. Well, the temple was gone. Now, what was holding them back? With so much uncertainty, a lot of Jews just headed for the seaports. Jews spread out in every direction. They called this movement the diaspora, the dispersal, and it became a great big deal in the years to come. What happened to these Jews, the diaspora? Though they were very different, they appear to have had a lot in common. Even though they settled in different communities and different countries, even though they took up a variety of jobs and trades, they rarely adopted the local religions or joined freely into the community. They typically lived in enclaves with other Jews. They still circumcised their sons and got drunk at Passover. They kept speaking Hebrew among themselves, and they didn't teach it to outsiders. And that, by the way, is an important fact. So here's an interesting item mentioned in more than one history. The menfolk in the places they settled found the Jewish women uber attractive. It's like those women gave off pheromones or something. There's a real penthouse letter quality to the description of the expat Jewish women. But the Jewish women would not have anything to do with those men unless they got themselves circumcised. If the menfolk did that, however, the women would take them as husbands and give them hot sex, and the men would be accepted into the expat Jewish community. Those were the first converts to Judaism. Along with the sort of typical trades you might expect, a lot of Jews took up mercenary soldiering. They'd gotten a reputation for fierce fighting, and a lot of armies hired them on, forming scary elite units of Jewish mercenaries, the Inglorious Bastards of their day. I swear this is true. Within a few years after the destruction of Jerusalem, all over the world, there were communities of Jews. And remember, you were a Jew because of blood, because you were part of a family. All the Jews were cousins. Judaism wasn't a religion, or rather, it wasn't simply a religion. It was a birthright. So if you were to imagine a sort of Old Testament Professor Xavier with a sort of Old Testament cerebro that could track every Old Testament Jew on the planet before the exile, there'd be about a million little Jewish lights, and all of them would be in a little area about the size of Rhode Island, and most of them would be in Jerusalem. 80 years later, after the return, Professor Xavier would see roughly the same number of lights, but now not so localized anymore. Now they'd be scattered all over Cerebro's map, little glowing pockets all over Greece and Macedonia and all along the seacoast of the Mediterranean, and lots along the Euphrates in Babylon, what we now call Iraq, and some in Antioch, and quite a few in Persia, and a little bunch in Jerusalem, and scattered like sparkles all over the territory that used to be so full Israel, and down into Egypt and North Africa. The Jews in Jerusalem didn't much like their crappy duct tape temple. They wanted a nice temple. They wanted to share some of the glorious new learning that they'd developed, the new Hebrew alphabet, the written Torah. And the Pharisees in particular were anxious to spread their vision of the moral application of the law in daily life. The Pharisees did not much like the Sadducees. They even had a catchphrase: a learned momser has more value than an ignorant high priest. They wanted all Jews to be learned. They set themselves up as rabbis, a term that has come to be translated as teachers, and many became missionaries to the scattered Jewish community. So over the course of a few years, many of these communities had rabbis. The rabbis brought with them copies of the Torah in the new Hebrew script. They taught the Jews how to read. And while they were at it, the rabbis brought with them their cool new interpretations about how to live according to Hashem's law, even if you couldn't make it to the temple, which of course a lot of the Jews were too far away to do. These expat Jews were kind of feeling themselves in a bind. They really wanted to be on Hashem's good side. Remember the whole sins of the father visited on the sons thing, but there was no honking way they were getting to the temple. But there was no honking way they were getting to the temple to sacrifice a dove. And here was this rabbi making them read aloud every damn little misdemeanor that they could screw up. So they worked like hell to keep things the way the rabbi said to keep them. And if that meant no cheeseburgers, so the hell be it. Now the Pharisees, as I have said a gazillion times, were big on prophecy. And this was the golden age of prophecy. In fact, there was a kind of a prophecy of the month club. The Pharisees were regularly sending out these latest and greatest prophecies from Ezekiel and Zephaniah and Hezekiah and a lot of other prophets who never made it into the Bible. Prophecies full of angels and resurrections and last judgments and all the other cool stuff that the Pharisees had picked up in Babylon to all the rabbis and all the outposts all over the world. Of course, these prophecies were scary as shit. The world was going to go kablooey in a minute or so. But the Jews at Antioch or Alexandria or wherever would read the prophecy and have a heart attack and then beg the rabbi to please send back with a messenger a few shekels to the wonderful, thoughtful Pharisees who had sent the prophecy. And oh, by the way, a few extra shekels for the priests at the temple to sacrifice a few lambs in hopes the world wouldn't end right away. And it wasn't long before the Sadducees began to piggyback their letters with the Pharisees, requests for love offerings. The altar could really use a nice polishing, only 500 shekels. We'll even put up a nice plaque with your name on the base and so on. You see, the Jerusalem of those days wasn't that much different than in our own times. When I say that the exile planted the seeds of modern Judaism, you may not have realized how broadly that statement applied. Of course, the Pharisees went along. They wanted a nicer temple as much as the Sadducees did. Maybe they thought the law required a different level of daily behavior, but they didn't deny the importance of the temple. And the Sadducees needed the goodwill of the Pharisees to maintain the continuity of the high priesthood. The Persians had seen to that. So they had set aside offices at the temple for the scribes and set aside special colonnades along the temple walls where the Pharisees could sit in the shadow of the tabernacle and discuss with anyone who wanted the finer points of the law. The Pharisees liked that, and they didn't want to mess with it. So there was cooperation, if not peace. And perhaps you were very observant. Did you just notice something rather important, that messages were going back and forth from the temple to the expat Jewish communities and money? The expat Jews certainly did. Those expat Jews were sharp. "While you're sending a note back to Benjamin, the scribe of the temple," said an expat in Antioch to his rabbi one day, "could you ask Benjamin the scribe to pass along this note to my expat cousin Jacob in Tarsus? Here's a couple of shekels for your trouble." That's all it took. Of course, Benjamin the scribe would be happy to do that. And soon, in Jerusalem, the Pharisee scribes and messengers were coming and going with notes to all the expat Jewish communities on a regular basis, along with the usual prophecies and news from the temple. It had been so simple to start adding message delivery to the mix. A central sorting station at the temple, that was all it took. Shake the incoming bag of messages on the table, sort them into the outgoing message bags for a small fee, done. Of course, it wouldn't take long before somebody in Antioch, let's call her Sarah, wanted to send a few shekels to her cousin Elizabeth in Alexandria, but that gets dicey. Carrying cash money gets very dicey. So the rabbi, hearing this request, would say no, forcing Sarah to weep, which is never pleasant. After Sarah wept on several occasions, Sarah's husband, let's call him Uriah, had enough. He went to the rabbi and had a long heart-to-heart. Then he told Sarah he was going to Jerusalem. When he got to Jerusalem, Uriah met with one of the Pharisees and offered this plan. Uriah would give the Pharisees some money, say 100 shekels. The Pharisees would keep 50 and give the other 50 to the rabbi in Alexandria. When Sarah wanted to send money to her sister in Alexandria, the Antioch rabbi would send along a note to the Alexandria rabbi, who would release some shekels to the sister. If funds ran low, the Alexandria rabbi could always ask the Pharisee to cover for some of the remaining 50, and the Pharisee would provide it. The Pharisee thought about this, and it all seemed pretty reasonable. But then Uriah added a couple of points. "Now suppose somebody in Alexandria wanted to send some shekels to Antioch," said Uriah. "Okay," said the Pharisee. "Tell the rabbi to collect the money and have him send a note. I, Uriah, will cover the amount in Antioch. And there will be money with the rabbi in Alexandria the next time Sarah wishes to send money to her sister." "What?" said the Pharisee. For suddenly he got the idea. "That's right," Uriah said. "This way, instead of sending shekels, all we need to do is send notes. And at some point, when we want, we take our notes to the temple and settle up." "What you're describing," said the Pharisee, "is a brilliant concept that has never been seen before. In a few centuries, however, it will become very popular and it will have a name. It will be called the modern banking system." "Is that so?" said Uriah. "Yes," said the Pharisee. "In the meantime, I'm off to see the high priest. You just stay here. I'm going to tell him the whole thing was my idea. You see, Money is a pain in the ass, particularly in those days when money meant metal. Money back then was heavy. Money was hard to carry and easy to steal. There was another problem with money, which we'll get to later. For one thing, it was hard to guarantee its value. Gold and silver were easy to adulterate, and coins were easy to counterfeit. Another trick was clipping. Take a gold or silver coin and snip a little bit from the edge. I found buried in the ground an actual Mogul coin that should have been as big as a quarter, and what I dug up was the size of a dime. It had been clipped that many times. That's why modern coins have milled edges to discourage clipping. But milled edges wouldn't get invented for a few more years. But for now, let's just focus on the problem of theft, which is big, because it's not just the theft, is it? It's the violence. Those messengers returning from Antioch or Athens to the temple would clearly be carrying love gifts for the temple, and every brigand on the route would know it. They'd be sitting ducks, and brigands wouldn't care if they had to kill the poor messenger to get the dough, or worse, maim them for life. That wasn't their problem. But if funds were going both ways, both to and from the temple, then the amounts and distances being carried would be much less, and that reduced the potential for death or worse. In fact, if you could convince someone to accept a note of guarantee in payment, another Jew perhaps, who didn't need shekels right away, you might be able to transfer funds without moving any actual cash at all. But this concept, moving money with notes of guarantee, by checks, so to speak, only works if there is a whole network of trust. The temple and the priests and the rabbis and the families of the Jewish diaspora provided that network of trust. And believe me, sending a check sure beats moving big bags full of heavy coins. This was an idea that had legs. So the temple had a kind of a post office and a kind of central bank. At this early point in their development, these were just nice little family conveniences for keeping the Jews connected and for keeping lines of communication and finances open between the Jews. But Jews doing a little business in different parts of the world found it much easier than other non-related people in different parts of the world were finding the same sorts of tasks. If you were some guy in Alexandria, you might never know that some guy in Antioch had exactly the sort of lace that would be a big hit with Alexandrian widows. And even if you did, how would you manage to find a way to communicate, let alone to pay that guy? But the Jews, with a central messaging system and a central banking system, had those methods. What the Jews didn't have yet, what nobody had yet, was an easy way to move goods from Antioch to Alexandria. If the goods were little, like a few pieces of lace, the Jews could probably use the temple post office. Nobody else could do that, but really, who cares about a little lace? What if they wanted to move something important, something big, like a ton of wheat or some cypress lumber? That wasn't happening. That was still a pain in the ass. There were still so many different borders and laws and dangerous passages full of murderers and highwaymen and corrupt border guards, and everyone spoke different languages at every point. Yikes! But over the next few decades, all of that was going to change. All the world was going to change. And when it did, Jerusalem was going to become the center of the world. What made it all change was Alexander the Great. I do so love Alexander. He wanted to change the world, and he totally did it. And he had a terrific time, and then he died. When guys like me first heard our therapists tell us that we were narcissists, and we replied, "Oh, really? What's a narcissist?" And the therapist stumbled around for a few answers and then finally gave the example of Alexander the Great, we instantly got it. And then the therapists elaborated and said, "Except you're not as great as Alexander the Great." And then we really got it, because that's the thing about Alexander. He was really, really great. Alexander had been trained by Aristotle himself, and he so loved the brilliance of Greek thought and Greek governance and Greek language and Greek culture and Greek art and Greek everything that when he looked in the mirror, he recognized that nobody else in the world was smarter than him or prettier or braver. So one day he just decided that he was going to make the whole world Greek and become everyone's beloved king. It took Alexander a little less than 10 years to conquer the entire civilized world from Greece and Serbia and all those Eastern Bloc countries all the way across the Middle East and Asia Minor to Pakistan and Afghanistan and down into India and down through the Middle East, completely conquering Persian and Babylon and, of course, Israel and Jerusalem and Egypt and a lot of North Africa. Not a bad decade. Nice going, Alexander. And smart. Was he ever? He didn't just beat hell out of every army he met. Following behind the army was the Alexander the Great government in a box. The neocons got this bright idea from Alexander, and they tried it when they invaded Saddam's Iraq, but they weren't as smart as Alexander. Alexander killed or exiled the government officials of the conquered land and replaced them with a government smart, benevolent, highly educated, trained Greeks. The new government only spoke Greek. If you wanted to get something done, you had to ask them politely in Greek. So pretty soon, everybody in the conquered country was learning how to speak Greek as a second language. Alexander's newly installed Greek-based governments were democratic mostly, which were a refreshing change from the nasty autocracies they replaced. So the conquered countries didn't mind being conquered. Alexander was their hero. A lot of their young men signed up to join his army for the next big battle, as he always won, and he rewarded his soldiers well. But to join, you had to learn Greek, dress Greek, and eventually think Greek. This started to happen in Judea. The high priest stayed the same. The council of elders stayed the same. But there was a Greek-speaking governor and a flurry of interest in joining Alexander's army. Israel was no different than any place that Alexander conquered. In an incredibly short amount of time, the entire civilized world began to unify around Alexander's vision of Greek culture. It reminds me so much of modern times when, no matter where you go in this world, everyone speaks some English. Everybody wears blue jeans and a Nike t-shirt and a Lakers cap with the brim turned backwards. Throughout Alexander's empire, which is the world my story cares about, everyone had learned a little Greek, and women started wearing the hymation and peplos and sewing up their hair in braids, and men began to wear short skirts and to shave. So almost overnight, Alexander changed a fractured, multinational, multilingual, multicultural world into a diverse but unified world with one government, one official language, one default culture. Suddenly, the complexity of transporting a ton of wheat from Antioch to Alexandria became possible. All the paperwork, the orders, the invoices, the bill, the content declaration, the bills of lading, all the bureaucratic hocus-pocus that existed 3,000 years ago, maybe even worse than today, now needed to be done once, not dozens of times, and in Greek only, not in dozens of languages. Now the road and seas were relatively safe, and there was only one guard's command to bribe for safe passage, not dozens along the way. Trade over long distance had just become simpler thanks to Alexander. But knowing what to trade and paying for that trade was still a pain in the ass. Unless, of course, you happened to be an expat Jew. Alexander may have unified the world, but he had not established anything remotely like the amazing communications and financial network that the Jews had in place. There was nothing comparable to that network. In fact, there was probably no way anything would ever be remotely comparable. As the potential for longer distance trade became real, merchants realized the value of the Jews' temple network. They wanted in. When they explored it with the expat Jews, they could not believe their luck. You see, cash wasn't the only thing that robbers made a trade in stealing. They also stole messages between merchants. Knowledge is more than power. Knowledge is money. Communications between tradesmen could be quite valuable. Getting hold of a merchant's frantic order for a purchase of wheat, sending the order to a different supplier, and the wheat to a different merchant, well, there was money to be made. And it was dishonest, maybe, but it wasn't technically a crime. But the communications to and from the temple were written in Hebrew. And no one wrote or read Hebrew but the Jews. If one of those messages went astray, it was a pain in the ass, but no long-term harm was done. And the same with the promissory notes or notes of guarantee. Easy to forge a note of guarantee in Greek or Persian, maybe, not so with Hebrew. Only Jews could write it, and none but Jews could read it. So the temple-based Hebrew-only network of the Jews had a character similar to the encrypted internet communications that make Amazon and other e-commerce websites possible. Trusted communications that can't easily be deciphered or misused. It didn't take long for merchants and traders to realize the value of what the Jews had put in place. It didn't take long for them to persuade the Jews to let them piggyback onto the temple network. The merchants were glad to ante up to do this. There was big money to be made, and making a generous love gift to the temple was simply the price of entry, and not such a steep one, really. The increase in the volume of trade in Alexander's newly unified world and the dependency of that trade on the Jews, the temple, and Jerusalem is absolutely astonishing. It reminds me of the way we've embraced the internet in modern times. Suddenly, the Jews weren't those people over there at the edge of town that kept to themselves, thank heaven. The Jews were those people you wanted to have over to lunch, even though you had no idea what you could serve them to eat. The locals started calling the Jewish enclaves synagogues, the Greek word for assembly, instead of the nastier words they used to use. Every major trading house wanted its in-house Jew. Jews in major cities could form consulting firms and hire out their services on an as-needed basis. Naturally, since they were writing up secret messages and moving secret funds, they were privy to all sorts of tantalizing information, and they might, even without breaking or even stretching confidences, find ways to utilize some of that information to enrich themselves and others, other merchants and other Jews. Of course, thanks to the Pharisees and the rabbis, all the Jews had learned to read and write Hebrew, and they could write to one another anywhere in the world. But the Jews in Babylon spoke Babylonian at home, and the Jews in Alexandria spoke Egyptian. Now all of them were picking up a little pidgin Greek just to get along. In Jerusalem, however, the bright young Jews were learning Greek as fast as they could. Knowing serviceable Greek and Hebrew was like having a law degree and a Harvard MBA. Alexander had come back from India, married a nice Persian girl, decided he didn't feel so good, went to bed early that night, and died. And the Jews were about to take over the world. Of course, that's not how Alexander saw it. Before he died, he called his four closest generals to his deathbed and divided his world between them. The two divisions that concern us were named for their first two rulers, Ptolemy and Seleucus. Practically, all the descendants of the first Ptolemy kept the same name, which is confusing, but nice and simple. The Ptolemaic Empire, basically, was Egypt and North Africa, and the coast of the Mediterranean where Gaza, Israel, and Lebanon now sit. They also owned Cyprus and a chunk of Turkey. The Ptolemy's capital was Alexandria. The Seleucids owned pretty much everything else in the Middle East, from Turkey to Afghanistan, including Persia and Babylon. The names of the rulers of the Seleucid Empire typically alternated between Seleucus and Antiochus. The Seleucids' capital was Antioch, in what is now Turkey, just north of Lebanon. Alexander thought he'd given Ptolemy a nice but much less valuable chunk of real estate than Seleucus. But he didn't realize how wrong that would turn out to be. He'd given him Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was about to become the richest place on earth. The Jews had just begun to discover the wonders of banking. There are several wonders. The first wonder is reasonable fees. They would charge a reasonable fee for transferring funds, which the merchants would gladly pay. After all, a slight fee for a guaranteed transfer is way better than paying no fees and having some robber take everything. But these fees were presented like a tithe, 10%, and that seems reasonable. But 10% means 10% when the money goes into the temple and 10% when it goes out from the temple. In other words, 20%, which isn't a bad deal for the temple, since in fact, nothing would really be changing hands at all in most cases, except a piece of paper with some Hebrew words. Next, they discovered the magic of exchange rates. Although these countries had been conquered by Alexander, they all had different coins and currencies. The merchant in Antioch had crescents. The merchant in Alexandria wanted talents. How was this to be managed? The temple solved this problem by establishing a standard currency, the temple shekel. They established uniform exchange rates between various currencies and temple shekels, with a reasonable fee for the exchange on both ends. And finally, they discovered the float. Eventually, somebody would actually demand cash payment for the note of guarantee they had received, but not for the longest time. It would be notes changing hands, not actual cash. As long as people believed the temple had the cash, the Jews realized, it was practically the same as having the cash. And this principle, by the way, is exactly the way banks operate today. This is why George Bailey freaks out when his depositors all show up at the same time and ask for their money. He doesn't actually have their money. As long as the cash isn't specifically being asked for, the temple realized, it could be used for other purposes, like lending to others. So the temple began not only to exchange funds, it began to lend funds. When that merchant in Cyprus heard about a great deal on a load of frankincense in Tarsus, he didn't have the cash. His staff Jew might suggest that he borrow the money from the temple, and presto, the deal would happen for a reasonable fee. And within a very short time, the temple expanded its lending from merchants to the royal houses of the world. In a few short years, everybody owed money to the Jews. Now let's talk about Jerusalem. A lot was happening there. A lot of change was going on. That nasty little duct tape city was the place to be. It was where the money was. People who wanted to be in the center of the action started flocking there. And you know the kind of people I mean. Well-heeled people wearing sincere ties with power handshakes or whatever the Old Testament equivalent was. Actually, I'll tell you what the Old Testament equivalent was. People who spoke Greek, who wore fancy Greek clothing, who ate Greek food, who lived in Greek-style houses, who washed at Greek baths and had their hair sewn into Greek-style braids or had shaved Greek-style chins, who begged favors of Greek gods at the Greek temples that had sprung up around the city, and to show how with it they were, went to those fun Greek-style orgies. I'm talking about Jews. How bad was it getting? Jewish men of this era, the second book of Maccabees tells us, were so embarrassed at the Greek baths about having their circumcised penises hanging out there for all the world to see that they were taking steps to restore their foreskins. And in case you're wondering how that gets done, the circumcised Jews used a device known as the pundus judaeus, which resembles a trombone mouthpiece, a heavy piece of brass that fits over the glands of the penis and gets attached by a string to whatever bit of foreskin remains. and then the weight is allowed to hang free and it tugs on the foreskin, in time slowly stretching it over the glands. I probably don't need to tell you this whole procedure can go horribly, painfully wrong. The process takes several months. And in the second century, the Jews changed the way the circumcision was done to reduce the amount of residual foreskin, making it harder to restore. And there's a number of devices you can buy today on the internet that take similar approaches. Anyway, Jerusalem was rich. Temple City was a kind of rodeo drive. Touristas came to the temple not to be awed, as they had in Solomon's day, but to show the scribes and the Pharisees and the priests that they were rich and decent men of good character, totally deserving of a big fat loan. A good way to show this was by making a substantial gift to the temple or to sacrifice a few oxen. The priests would never take a bribe directly, but they'd take their tenth share of a few oxen. Jerusalem was rich in sacrificial meats. The temple itself, once duct taped together, now looked great. All those love gifts alone would have made it shine, but let's be frank, the temple had money to burn. The new tabernacle wasn't as tall or as fine as Solomon's, but it had been faced in marble now and beautifully inlaid with gold and onyx and jasper. The courtyard of musicians played constantly, and the instruments were the finest money could buy. The altar roared with fire. Animals were being slaughtered in cartloads. Priests carried sacrifice up the earthen ramps in pairs. Rich, dark smoke hung heavy over the courtyard. The hill behind the temple was a magnificent community of great walled houses where the priests made their homes. To be selected as a chief priest of the temple was to be guaranteed a lifetime of wealth and ease. But I should point out that the priests had kept the faith. Solomon's temple had descended into idolatry almost overnight, remember, but the new temple had stayed completely free of idols, completely true to the law ever since the return. The Sadducees had maintained a fierce adherence to the letter and the spirit of the law so far as the temple rituals were concerned. But beneath the temple, where once had only been the tunnels built by King David to provide fresh water, now there were treasure rooms, and those rooms were filled with gold. The Pharisees and the Sadducees continued to work together in the Council of Elders, as the Persians had defined. They continued to cooperate. Who could argue with success? In the countryside of Israel, life was not quite so wonderful. It wasn't bad. Farmers farmed, herders kept their flocks, life went on as usual. Every village had its rabbi and its priest. All the village priests longed, of course, to go to Jerusalem. Otherwise, they were content. The city was rich and paid well for what the villages provided. Three times a year, the Jews made their pilgrimage to the temple, but now they felt like strangers there. They felt like bumpkins. The Ptolemies, as rulers of this land, were not ambitious. They taxed it, but lightly. They were content. They replaced Alexander's governor with a man of their own, but it had not been so long since they had had a country of their own. I got to try that again.
Okay.
The Ptolemies, as rulers of this land, were not ambitious. They taxed it, but lightly. They were content. They replaced Alexander's governor with a man of their own. But it had been so long since they'd had a country of their own, the Jews hardly noticed. The Seleucids, on the other hand, were different from the laid-back Ptolemies. The Seleucids had ambition. Israel sat at the edge of the Seleucid border, right there for the taking. And it wouldn't be long before they decided they would take it. Now, the thing was, nobody wanted a war fought in Israel. Why? Because the temple was the goose that was laying golden eggs. The temple was where the money came from. The temple was how business got done in the whole wide world. So when the Ptolemies and Seleucids started puffing their chests and threatening each other, everybody in the whole wide world with any influence sent word to the kings of these two countries to work things out, to fight things out if they had to, but to make goddamn sure that Jerusalem didn't get hurt. This would be the first of many battles between these countries about the ownership of Israel, and none of them got fought in Israel. Anyway, this battle, like most of them, got fought in Gaza, north of Alexandria, and the gentle Ptolemies crushed the much more warlike Seleucids. But that battle put some worry in the Ptolemies. They'd been lax in protecting Jerusalem. So they built a great big round tower next to the temple wall and called it the Citadel and put a garrison of soldiers there just to show the Seleucids they meant business. Life went on. A couple of decades passed and the Seleucids had another go, same result. Another decade. Another attempt. And this time, the Seleucids won, and now Israel was in Seleucid hands. Well, not much changed at first. The Seleucids installed a Seleucid governor. Probably the only person to pay much attention was the high priest who reported to him. The governor raised taxes a little, then a little more. The Judeans might have expected that. They hoped it wouldn't be a habit. Judeans did notice, however, big time, what was going on at that big citadel tower next to their temple. First, it had been emptied, as the Ptolemies frantically sent every man they had at the citadel down to Gaza to do battle against the Seleucids. So the citadel, meanwhile, had just sat there like a ghost mansion, gathering cobwebs for months, even after the new Seleucid provincial governor was installed. The Judeans thought. Maybe the Seleucids are even more laid back than the Ptolemies. At first, the idea pleased them. Then they weren't so sure. They needn't have worried. The situation resolved quite obviously soon enough. You see, the Seleucid kings had a very different idea of themselves than the Ptolemies. It was surprising, really, sort of the opposite of what you might expect. The Ptolemies ruled Egypt, where the ancient kings had thought of themselves to be gods. The Ptolemies didn't go for that. They knew they were human and acted like it. The Seleucids, on the other hand, totally bought into that whole us kings are gods idea. To the Seleucid kings, since any temple belonged to the gods, and since they believed themselves to be both gods and kings, any temple sort of de facto belonged to them. Now this particular Seleucid king called Antiochus, the one who just beat the hell out of the Ptolemies, was one greedy son of a bitch. And he had made up his mind to start looting the treasuries of his temples. He meant to loot a lot of them, of course, but the one he really had his sights set on was the temple in Jerusalem. So he sent a great, big, mean-ass garrison of troops to the citadel. These were not his run-of-the-mill soldiers, not like the ones the Ptolemies had sent when they were in charge. These were his shock troops, the Seleucid equivalent of the SS. They were the scary, black-hearted, take-no-prisoners mercenaries that gave little children nightmares, the world's deadliest tag team, Spartans and Jews. The Ptolemy garrison had kept its patrols quiet. The Seleucids marched noisily through Jerusalem in full shiny armor, spears raised, shields held high, banners flying, stomping hard, knocking things down if anything got in their way, making a big show of intimidating strength. Who, the Judeans wondered, was the show for? Not the Ptolemies. They'd scurried back to Egypt with their tails between their legs. No, the Judeans realized, they were the ones meant to be intimidated. And they were. Like I said, Antiochus was a greedy bastard, and the kingdom's temples, his temples, as he perceived them, seemed to him to be easy pickings. Those temples might not have been as rich as the Jerusalem temple, but a lot of them were pretty rich in love offerings. So Antiochus sent his trusted general around with an elite squad of soldiers and a bunch of wagons and started carting off their gold. And after a few successful parades at some of the lesser temples, Antiochus decided to send his man to Jerusalem and have a go at the mother of all temples. Things did not go as expected. The general brought his band of troops and wagons right into the courtyard. Assuming that the treasury would be inside, he personally stormed up the steps and into the tabernacle. And when he entered, he saw clearly angels. Lucky for the Jews, they discovered angels. First, an angel on an angel horse who ran him down and knocked him to the ground. Then two very handsome, well-dressed, muscular angels who stood on each side of him and beat hell out of him with scourges. Eventually, the general's men came in and carried him out on a stretcher. The general rounded up his men and galloped off empty-handed, straight back to Antioch. The king, of course, was anxious to meet him. He expected to get a favorable report and some nice prize love offerings. What he got instead was the general's sword right through his heart. While he wiped the blood from his sword, the general declared that because of the king's sinful action, the general had been forced to take the throne, and he was now the rightful king. A few days later, Antiochus' son and heir, named, you guessed it, Seleucus, asked to speak with the new self-styled king. The general agreed, and the son stabbed him to death with a hidden knife. The Seleucids rejoiced. Justice had been done. A few weeks later, Seleucus' brother, yet another fellow named, wouldn't you know it, Antiochus, poisoned his newly crowned brother and declared himself to be the new king. I want you to go over that last section in your mind again, and this time imagine it by picturing yourself as someone living in Jerusalem, hearing about those events. Imagine yourself in Jerusalem, where a garrison specially chosen to be scary is tramping in full armor right past your house. And what do you make of that story? What's your confidence that the new God King Antiochus, the fourth of that name, is any less greedy or less murderous than the rest of his crazy family? What's your confidence that those evil-looking mercenaries who just marched past will decide to obey an order from that crazy new king? You know that Jewish mercenaries are supposed to be the scariest people on earth, but it's just crazy. Who would send Jews to scare Jews? Yet actually, it's even scarier, even crazier, because it's so crazy. You think about the new God King's father who sent men to loot the temple. How long will it take before this new one gets the same idea? Jerusalem, you realize, is in deep doo-doo. Well, there's a guy in Jerusalem thinking about those questions really, really hard, and he's going to make something big happen. The curtain's about to go up on the penultimate episode of our story. But before we talk about him, let's get up and personal with the villain of our piece. The man we've been waiting for since night one, Antiochus the Fourth, or as he likes to be called, Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus God on Earth. That's what he calls himself. That's a hell of a title to crown yourself with, isn't it? Gives you an idea of the man's personality, doesn't it? Kills his brother, plops the stolen crown on his head, and calls himself God on Earth. What a guy. Yes, he's crazy as a loon and has no moral compass. He is also smart as hell. He was brought up in Athens, tutored at the same academy as Alexander was, where he was the star pupil like Alexander. He's a great believer in democracy and republican principles. Like Alexander, he believes it's his destiny to rule the entire world. Rule it, he believes it belongs to him already, and he can't figure out why other people haven't figured it out. He's like Caligula, except with less self-control. I'm imagining him right now, sitting by himself in his throne room. He's not feeling bad about killing his own brother or thinking that there might be global economic consequences if he loots the temple, which is the engine of the world economy. No, he's thinking about what happened to that general in the tabernacle and saying to himself, so it's going to be a god-on-god throwdown. The ultimate cage fight between me and the so-called king of the universe. That god is going down. Yes, my story has a villain, and this is him. I've been holding my breath for 6 nights, just waiting for him to show up. Now, that person in Jerusalem who was thinking about the troublesome recent events in Antioch, the one coming up with a really brilliant plan, was named Jason. Jason was the brother of the current high priest, Onias. Now, the books of Maccabees present Jason as, you can take your choice, a villain or a douchebag. And for the 30 years or so that I have studied this story, I have thought of him in this way, bouncing between these two options. But about a year ago, I realized there was a third option, which I'd like to share. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you what Jason did, which is why the Chronicles present him as a douchebag villain. And then I'm going to tell you my brilliant take, and then you can decide if that makes any damn difference to you at all. I'll tell you this much. No matter what you think of what Jason did, the way things finally went down afterwards was a bigger fucked up mess than anyone could imagine. So here are the facts. Nobody has any alternate facts to present. Jason went to Antiochus Epiphanes, the god king of the Seleucid, with this deal. Antiochus should fire Jason's brother and make Jason the high priest instead. Antiochus should make the client state of Judea, including Jerusalem, into an independent polis, a city-state. And the new polis would be named Antioch in honor of guess who? And since it would not be a province, the polis would not be ruled by a provincial governor. Instead, it would be ruled by the high priest, in other words, by Jason. And the high priest would build a gymnasium in the temple courtyard. And the high priest would have the authority to establish taxes and to oppose capital punishment. And the polis would pay each year as tribute to Antiochus 360 talents of pure silver. Now a talent was a unit of weight about 60 pounds. 360 talents was almost 22,000 pounds. That's the equivalent of more than 5 full-size solid silver automobiles, or a stack of American silver dollars over 8 miles tall. That's so tall that jetliners would need to swerve to avoid it. So a few points about this deal were a little disturbing to the Jews, according to the Maccabees authors. First, high priests had never been forcibly replaced and had never been appointed by a foreign king. So Jason's plan to force his brother to quit this way was really galling. Second, the high priest was establishing himself as the ultimate civil authority. Taxation was never a high priest's role before, or capital punishment. That was really scary. Third, calling Jerusalem Antioch? Are you fucking kidding me? Fourth, the Council of Elders was supposed to determine who the high priest was, not the other way around. Fifth, so obviously, the 5 solid silver automobiles a year are coming out of the temple treasury. What, the treasury is now Jason's private piggy bank? Sixth, a gymnasium in the temple courtyard? Are you fucking kidding me? And so on. Yes, at first glance, Jason does seem to be in the lead for the Douchebag of the Year award. Actually, on second glance, third glance, and 5,000th glance. But I've recently come to see a different, much more positive interpretation. I think Jason was trying really hard to find a way to return Israel to Jewish control and was trying to take advantage of Antiochus's education, egotism, and greed to make this happen. Let's start with his greed. Jason played him like a cheap fiddle, sure. Antiochus could try to loot the temple, but if he tried on his own to take out that much silver even once, he'd face anger and violence from the Judeans every step of the way. There'd be blood and death and rebellion, and that could lead to insurrection throughout the kingdom. He could pay a heavy price, or he could get as much for free and establish a precedent for other temples in the kingdom. Antiochus' egotism, well, obviously, Antioch, flatter, flatter, flatter. And the whole polis thing played into Antiochus's education. You see, Antiochus had gotten lots of modern Greek ideas while he studied in Athens, just like Alexander had. And Alexander had made a name for himself by putting his education into action. Jason was helping Antiochus see ways to develop this self-styled connection with Alexander. Jason sort of guessed that Antiochus wanted to end up being called Antiochus Epiphanes the Great, and probably had gotten wind that the king was hoping to use polis development as a way to do it. Same with the gymnasium suggestion. The whole idea of gymnasiums, this whole healthy mind and a healthy body thing, was like the uber Greek ideal. And gymnasiums weren't just like 24-hour fitness centers. They were places of learning where smart Greek philosophers held forth on whatever the hell smart Greek philosophers were holding forth on in those days. Putting one in the temple would offer a modern, with it counterpoint to the old-fashioned, superstitious nonsense being practiced by the Jews 100 yards away. Those were the sweeteners to Jason's deal. The less obvious elements were these, that Jason really believed that the time had come for Israel to step up and have its own ruler again, with the same authority as its ancient kings. And he guessed that Antiochus would, in his heart of hearts, want to deal with an authority, not an underling. And Jason, I think, also shared the belief that it was time that the Jews should begin to branch out, and that they would never branch out into the wider world until they began to experience the richness and variety of Greek thought. Maybe some of the city Jews had already begun to do this, but the Jews in the country were still quite backward, held down by the strict fundamentalism of their rabbis. Yet 3 times a year at the temple, those Jews too would now have a chance to come into contact with Greek culture at that gymnasium. Last of all, Jason believed, I think, that a high priest governing Jerusalem would be able to assert command over a largely Jewish Seleucid garrison, should the need arise, to countermand one of Antiochus's orders. This was, I think, Jason's biggest concern. He really wanted to insert a buffer between Antiochus and the soldiers in Jerusalem. Even if it cost a stack of silver dollars 8 miles high, that would be worth it. And so Antiochus and Jason shook hands or fist bumped or whatever the hell guys like that did, and the deal was struck. I'm sorry to say, tomorrow night's story is going to be kind of a bummer. Boy, these things are long, David.